This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. Food and travel are some of my favourite things, and they form part of Abby Lay's book, Slip. Welcome, Abby.
Thank you, Jan. Thank you, David.
Before we slip into food and travel, we have to talk about the relationship that is put into question by the food and travel. What's Grace and Jack's relationship like?
It's a good question. I suspect they would have different perspectives of that themselves. So Grace and Jack have been together for about 6 years. They met when they were at law school together, and Jack went off to become a barrister, whereas Grace returned to her love, which is linguistics. And in many ways, they're on track. They have a future that they're both striving for. They live in an apartment that Jack has bought with his own money and are united in their goal, I think, to have a family and do envisage that they'll become married one day. And all of that is to say that they have the future, which is perhaps not the same as having the present. And so their relationship comes into sharp focus when Grace goes on a holiday that brings her fully into the present moment.
Comfortable, I think, is the word, yes. And she's a bit resistant about the wedding against tradition. And it's this whole thought about Jack's job, which he's taken a step up, but what's that done to their time together?
Well, it's greatly constrained it. So Jack's left private practice as a lawyer and gone to the bar, and most junior barristers just have to work their butts off for the first few years, but it becomes, I think, quite addictive, and there's a real ego drive there for Jack, who's grown up in a working class context and has found himself to be upwardly mobile through this very hierarchical, very formal kind of legacy profession that is the bar. So he finds himself drawn into that particular obsession, and it does come at a real cost to the quality of his relationship with Grace.
Grace wants to finish her thesis.
So she says.
So what's it on?
It's on linguistics, and so she focuses on Sicilian dialects in particular and the phonology of that language. So she loves the sound of Italian, and she loves the sound of dialect, despite not having any particular background herself.
There was a lovely quote in here, "Dialect, like jazz, unpredictable and a little surprising." Well, her decision to go to Italy to do this further research. And she's travelled to the Amalfi before with Alice. This is her sister, who she confides in a lot, because a lot of her best friends have got kids. Mm. And this is what she wants to do before the kids. So she's quite fluent in Italian, as you said, and she's trained her ear to eavesdrop conversations. This is a quote. "She felt for the contours of the sound, so much more liquid than English, so much more lively." So, where's she going to spend this next 7 weeks?
She'll be based in Palermo, which is a city on the northern coast of Sicily, and has carved out a little bit of time at the end where Jack is going to join her after his first big trial concludes. They spend some time in Salina in the Aeolian Islands, but most of the novel takes place on that northern coastline of Sicily.
She's found accommodation. Nico's family own the apartment block. He rents out apartments and rooms. Alice rents a room. What could she tell about Nico from looking at his bookshelves? And here's a little bit from page 39.
All right. So he was politically engaged, artistic, lazy but clean, relaxed, truthful to the extent that he had hosted other people before, as he had said, and seemed to have a creative streak, educated.
He's away. He's a uni lecturer, and he's away on summer holidays. So Grace is in Palermo at the height of the tourist season. How much conversation is she getting with the locals?
Very little, far less than she would like. I think she finds when she first arrives in Palermo that her expectation that the whole place will just crack open for her is not met, and she finds herself an outsider, a tourist that people are happy to have there, but only in the capacity as a tourist, whereas I think she sees herself as someone who's able to transcend that status, and she deeply wishes to connect with and have access to relationships that you have when you live locally somewhere. But I think in her mind, she hoped to bypass all of the time that you need to spend to really foster that sense of belonging.
It's just not coming. There's the cafeterias she goes to and the market. Now, Abby Lay has got a beautiful Italian accent, so I've chosen this bit for her to read when Grace is buying cheese. This is page 42.
She asked him for a selection of sottoli, a word she had already fallen in love with for its sound alone, and she understood from his patient smile that he detected her enjoyment in saying it. Last, she bought 5 different cheeses, some by accident and most in excessive quantities. Stracciatella, Parmigiano Reggiano, Cacio Cavallo, Asiago, and a replacement wedge of Provolone.
Makes cheddar seem so boring, doesn't it? It's hot in Palermo. Her visit to the beach is very different to one in Australia. Mm. What does it involve?
Well, it involves a lot of land already being gobbled up by these private lidi, they're called in Italy, where you need to pay a premium ticket for a very particular banana lounge or a lesser premium ticket in the afternoon if you only want to be there for a short amount of time. And it's often gated in a white picket fence, which feels important for the kind of economy that's created over there, where those who aren't willing to pay or perhaps can't pay are on a very thin slice of sand that sit out the front of these lidi. So it's very busy and quite privatised.
And even the sand, you have to quite often walk on a boardwalk.
Mm. As you deserve, if the sand is hot.
Well, finally, Nico comes home. How does the conversation change when he cooks her spaghetti?
To begin with, they have a kind of typical interaction when you're speaking in another language and you're really wanting to practice that. And that is, you go back to the beginning and you sort of tell the story of your life chronologically, and it follows this question and answer format, which is quite a formal and maybe truncated way of getting to know someone. But Nico and Grace very quickly discover that they share a real passion for food, even if they come at it from quite different perspectives and certainly skill levels. Grace is not the kind of cook that she would like to be, and that becomes apparent to her, I think, when she witnesses him cooking for the first time. He's able to cook very simple foods with really high quality ingredients and an intuition that she could only ever hope to cultivate, and her respect for him, I think, cuts its teeth in that first interaction they have over the spaghetti.
Yeah, you say that she's part of an authentic cultural immersion. Grace is meant to be going to Paris but stays in Palermo, and Nico takes her around and even introduces him to his friends. Then he helps her with her research. Mm-hmm. How does he do that?
He agrees to sit with her as though he were in a painting, and I think that's how he frames it in the novel. So she takes a dictaphone and records a conversation that the two of them have, which runs in parallel. So there's an aspect of it that's in classical Italian and then an aspect of it that's in Sicilian dialect, but it doesn't quite go as Grace envisages it to, and a lot comes through in the language that perhaps doesn't exist in the words.
They were sharing narratives of different cultures, but the lack of her own power in language made her feel helpless, especially with the question, 3 things you know that are true. Mm-hmm. That was a good question.
Thank you.
When Nico went away again, she wondered how long did it take for most people to feel lonely. Mm-hmm. Now, back to Grace and Jack. Mm-hmm. We'll let Abby Lay once again read from page 55 about Grace and Jack's sex life.
From 2 years in, Grace and Jack began to see sex as they did exercise. They knew it was good for them, and they did it for that reason. On their best days, they were smug about it, knowing that they exceeded the reputable statistics for people who had been together for as long as they had. And they never regretted it afterwards. Just as Grace never regretted laps at the pool or a productive burst of research. Good? Jack would ask. Good, Grace would reply. And she did mean it. Jack had once called her a sexual athlete, and Grace had basked in the glow of the compliment, in the implication of excellence.
So now, in Palermo, it's been a long time since Grace has had sex, and her imagination goes to nude drawings above the bed. What's her fantasy thoughts?
Well, her fantasy, it feels very original to her, which is that she would be drawn in the same way that the figure who is captured in those pieces of art above the bed would be drawn. And she begins with Jack, but that's not getting her there. So she turns to someone who she can more reliably count on in that regard, and that's Nico, who she has draw for her, like one of his French girls. And that's, of course, a reference to Titanic.
The imagination goes into a session of self-satisfaction. So who brings her around? Aha, we'll have to let the reader work that one out. Nico also asks about Jack. What does Grace tell him about Jack?
as little as she can. Mm. She scrubs Jack clean and presents him, I think, as less a person and more a collection of facts, because I think she finds that the part of her that's in a relationship with him is quite separate from the part of her that's in Italy there with Nico. So she chooses to reveal certain things and I think hopes to leave him as far away from her as is possible, which it turns out is not very possible when he's coming over to meet her.
And Grace thinks the differences are he doesn't like the beach, he doesn't cook, and he doesn't play sport. These are all things that Nico did. Jack comes for a visit. How would you describe the interaction between Jack and Nico?
quite tense, I would suggest. I think that their expectations of each other change, perhaps, when they meet. And they were probably never going to get along. They were never going to connect. But I do think that that interaction, I mean, Grace's actions have freighted that with expectation and meaning.
It's a quote from the book. Jack's voice had taken on the tone her father used when he received a call from a telemarketer. Rough. And his view was that Grace had created a fetish out of Nico. The title of the book is Slip. Why Slip?
So many reasons. It took like 18 months to come up with this title, I have to say. And so, I mean, a slip of the tongue.
Words can make different things the way they are said, but body language may remain the same. What does Jack see when Nico and Grace talk together?
I think he sees threat more than he sees anything else, and whether that's true or not, I'll let the reader discover, but he certainly perceives an intense threat.
Then there's another thought that she had. You can only truly know each other if you have a knowledge and fluency in the language you share. Will it be true? Because I've been to these places, I doubly loved it. And I was reading right to the end to find out just what was going to happen between Grace, Jack and Nico. Grace wants the cultural immersion of Italy, but has to decide if language barriers limit or enhance desire. Slip by Abby Lay could mean a slide for Grace back into or out of her comfortable relationship. Abby Lay, congratulations.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for reading.
And I just one last comment. Selecting a children's film as entertainment, assuming it would be harmless, but soon cut her off at the knees in revealing the marrow of life. I think you've seen some of the same kids' movies I've seen that you come out crying more.
More moved than any child is, that's for sure.
David.
Well, we go to the landscape of Australia, the linguistics of Australia, in Chris Hammer's novel Legacy. Not only do we have a murder and intrigue in Chris Hammer's latest novel, Legacy, but we also have the past, present and future of Australia woven into the narrative. So, Chris, welcome back to 3CR.
Oh, so good to be back here.
Now, the landscape is an integral part of, well, all your novels, but here it's virtually another character. Where are we and how does this landscape flood? Because the flood's a very important feature.
We're on a real river called the Paroo River. The Paroo runs in the desert. Technically, it's in the Murray-Darling Basin, but only just. It runs out through the desert a couple of hundred kilometres back of Bourke to the west. Every now and then, the Asian monsoon will penetrate far enough to drop a massive amount of water on what they call the tin roof country. It's up part Charleville. And it's very rocky and it's got a bit of elevation. So the water doesn't soak in. It runs off and picks up a bit of momentum and carves this river channel through the plain that then runs north to south for several hundred kilometres down across the Queensland border into New South Wales. By then, the land has become so flat. This flood is not what we think of as a flood. It's moving so slowly you can walk in front of it. And then eventually the land becomes so very flat, there is no impetus to drive the water further. So it spreads over this vast floodplain. an area maybe of tens of thousands of square kilometres. And the graziers there, they know the water's coming because it can take, you know, 3 or 4 weeks to reach them. Then they know how far it will spread out. They've got a pretty good idea how long it'll take that water to either soak in or evaporate, and then how long it will take the pasture to grow. And the pasture does grow. So the desert becomes green as Kent. And then knowing this is going to happen, they've got the time to order in cattle.
Now, I'm an old repatriated English teacher, and I reckon your use of the river and the flood is like a bit of a metaphor, because you've got all of these little channels and tributaries, and it's like this story that you've got with all of these rivulets coalescing very evenly and slowly and coming to a head. Let me explain what I'm talking about. You start with an epigraph from Henry Lawson, with blighted eyes and blistered feet, with stomachs out of order, half mad with flies and dust and heat, we've crossed the Queensland border. I long to hear a stream go by and see the circles quiver. I long to lay me down and die that night on Paroo River. So you're bringing in Australian literature into this landscape, but you've also got other narrative threads throughout this, which I want to tease out. So, for example, you've got Martin Scarsden. He's an old hand, an old journalist. What the hell is he doing in outback Australia?
So Legacy's first Martin Scarsden book for 5 years. And I think it was, I watched a TV series and it kind of sucked me in. I thought, what's going on here? And that got me thinking about Martin. And then in the second series, there's a scene that's not in the novel. And it's Martin launching a book. He's become a rather prominent true crime author, basically writing books based on what happens in my books. It's a bit meta like that. So I was watching the TV show and I thought, oh, this is interesting. What's going to happen here? Is something dramatic going to go off? So this book, Legacy, starts with a very similar book launch, except in this book it really does go pear-shaped. There's a bomb scare and people file out. They're a bit miffed, you know, but it's not a hoax. It's a real bomb and it goes off and it destroys the hall. Now, no one's hurt, no one's killed, but Martin pretty quickly concludes that someone is trying to kill him. He doesn't know who, he doesn't know why, but on the advice of the authorities, he flees westward beyond mobile phone range so he can't be tracked. And that's how he ends up on the Paroo. And so it's a bit different from the previous books, because in the previous books, Martin is kind of like the gun journos who's investigating crimes, often getting it wrong and all the rest of it. But he's got agency. This time, he's not in control of things.
And we're still trying to work out what it is or who is in fact after him. So that remains a thread in the background. Yep. But his mate, you talk of the authorities, Goffing, is ASIO.
Yep.
So we're pretty high up. And there's a book that he hasn't had published on the Mafia. Could that be it? So we're still trying to tease that out and find out if that is the reason he's being chased.
Yep.
So he's out there trying to remain incognito and it doesn't quite work. Another thread, Ekaterina Boland. Who is she and what is her role and what's she doing out there?
So she's a new character. It's Australia, so everyone calls her Echo. She lives in Brisbane, doesn't know Martin, he doesn't know her. But she's got a really scandalous past. She's been cancelled. Really through no fault of her own. She's rebuilding her life by being a ghostwriter, so working in the background, writing autobiographies for, you know, minor celebrities and sports stars, that sort of thing. Anyway, one of her projects, the one she's relying on for a big payday, doesn't happen. And desperate for money, she takes a commission to write a bespoke book for a grazing family that's been out for generations on the Paroo River, but in Queensland. So she heads out there. She's on the Paroo River in Queensland, and Martin is a couple of hundred kilometres south in New South Wales. But the reader's going to guess, you know, they're both in the same book. Sooner or later, their paths are going to cross, and they do in rather spectacular fashion. I probably won't say any more about that.
No, well, we can't give too much away. But Echo's role allows her in many ways to investigate the past. So you've got two graziers here, the Carmichaels and the Stantons. And it's a bit like the Hatfields and the McCoys. That's the term you use.
Yeah.
And they're actually playing for the water. So there's a reason we can channel the water to our advantage. But it also gives you an opportunity to look into, again, the history of Australia. There's, as Echo's trying to write the history of the Carmichaels, you get Indigenous questions arising. And so this weave, these tributaries of stories are there. And also she comes across a backwater of a story, shall we say, because you've got another thread, that of Chloe Carmichael and her journal entries or diary entries, which teases out the notion of an unsolved murder. What's going on there?
So you're right. Echo is commissioned to write this history. This old grazier, Clay Carmichael's brother, he's concerned about his legacy and preserving his legacy because his children, Chloe and Vincent, are not interested in the property that they've run for generations. But in commissioning her, he gives her access to the journals of the original settlers. You know, so there's elements of the frontier wars. But also, yeah, she comes across the journals of the daughter, Chloe. And Chloe is interesting because she's a killer. She's a wanted murderer. She's a fugitive. She's been on the run for 20 years. No one knows where she is. The Stantons, the other Warren family, believe that Clay knows and they're protecting her. So in researching this bespoke book, which she initially thinks is a bit of vanity publishing, she comes across not only Chloe's journals, but the journals of the early settlers that make reference to a very, almost a legendary, almost mythical Australian exploration. That's Ludwig Leichhardt. Now, Leichhardt became very famous because he blazed an overland trail between Brisbane and Darwin in the first half of the 19th century. And equipped with the fame and the funding that came from that, he then attempted to cross Australia from east to west, from Brisbane to Perth, what was then known as the Swan River Colony, and he disappeared into the desert and no trace was ever found. No one knows what happened to him, and it's became this great sort of unknown. You've got these two really famous expeditions back then, Burke and Wills, but we know what happened to Burke and Wills. There was a survivor, they found their bodies, they found their journals, it's all clear. But Leichhardt, he just vanished.
But there are two names she finds in those original journals.
So she does find something more than we know now. But I don't think we'll take that anymore, David. We'll leave that for the reason.
That's fine. And who is Chloe alleged to have murdered?
Well, she's alleged to have murdered her fiancé, the son, the heir of the Stantons, the other grazing family. So this is this feud that's gone for generations. They didn't get engaged. This is all 20 years ago. And hoping that the feud... So there's elements here of, yes, the Hatfields and McCoys, but probably also the Montagues and Capulets.
So then you sort of compel this story into the future as well, because the properties are up for sale, so to speak. You've got international interests. You've got contemporary journalism where things are fabricated, fake news. Yep. So how much can you reveal about this and what's going on there? Because that's the sort of future of Australia.
I think that's better left probably for the book of the imagination of the readers, really. But there is an element of, Echo's had a very rough run at life. There's a lot of things that have happened to her out of her control before the book starts. And then more terrible things happen to her. She's kind of, yes, framed using modern technology. But again, I don't want to go too far down that path.
But Martin's also framed as well. There are news stories coming out. There's all sorts of things, and we can't rely on it. Similarly, we can't necessarily rely on the authorities either. There is suspicion that has been raised in all these threads. So we don't know if the Carmichaels or the Stantons are corrupt or what they're doing and how water is involved here. Martin's suspicious about the authorities that have sent him out to the Paru to hide because he's pretty soon discovered because he's known. We've got these other threads and tributaries, backwaters. We've got a murder mystery from the past. We can even go into Australia's mythical history of exploration and the frontier wars. So all of these tributaries are moving forward ever so slowly, like the flooding river, and coalesce. And if the listener wants to find out more, they're going to actually have to read the book.
Yeah. But there is a flood coming. There is a flood coming down the river at the time that Echo and Martin find themselves up there. Of course, it arrives much later in the day for Martin in New South Wales than it does for Echo in Queensland.
So what is Australia's legacy? What is the legacy of these graziers? What is Martin's legacy, for that matter? One can find out in the book entitled Legacy. It's by Chris Hammer and it's an Allen and Unwin release. So, Chris, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Oh, look, wonderful to be back here and all the best to your listeners.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.